exploring the reality of the gentrifier and the gentrified.
Initially, in my naivete, I saw the police presence that followed gentrification as mostly a positive. You know, I had people who were walking my wife home, but police officers who were walking my wife home from the subway station 8 years ago, and they certainly weren't doing that with anybody else or telling me to put away my iPhone as I was getting out, as though I was a tourist in my own neighborhood. And then it was 5-6 years ago. I remember I'm a middle school teacher as well as a writer. And on my way to work, I think it was 4 out of 5 days in a week, I saw kids not much older than my eighth graders stopped and sort of shackled against that gate that separates the stairs up to the street from those down to the subway. And it was the same kids 3 or 4 days in a row. And I just remember the lived experience of stop and frisk being so difficult.
That's Brian Platzer. We talk with him about his novel, Bed-Stuy is Burning. Then we re-air our interview from 2017 with Peter Moskowitz about his book, How to Kill a City: Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. The Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, has been for decades home to one of the most vibrant black communities in the nation, a cultural center for Brooklyn's African-American population. It still is that. But its nature is fast changing. As gentrification sweeps through it, attracted by the stately 19th-century brownstones and repelled by the sky-high rents of other gentrified Brooklyn neighborhoods. Signs are everywhere of the influx of wealthier white people, bringing trendy restaurants and boutiques to supplant the bodegas and fast chicken places. Rents are already rising sharply, pushing out families that have been there for generations. Brian Platzer confronts the tensions between the gentrifier and the gentrified in his debut novel, Bed-Stuy is Burning. It focuses on what happens when Aaron, a disgraced rabbi turned Wall Street banker, and Amelia, his journalist girlfriend, come to live in Bedford-Stuyvesant with their newborn child. The infusion of upwardly mobile professionals into Bed-Stuy's historic brownstones belies the tension simmering on the streets. But after a cop shoots a boy in a nearby park, conflict escalates, with Aaron and his family at the center. Brian Platzer's writing has appeared in the New Yorker's Shouts and Murmurs column, as well as in the New York Times, The New Republic, Salon, and elsewhere. He lives with his wife and two sons in Bedford-Stuyvesant and teaches middle school English in Manhattan. Bed-Stuy is Burning is published by Simon & Schuster. Well, Brian Platzer, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this book, Bed-Stuy is Burning, you yourself live in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and in fact, your story is not all that different than the character, main character of your book. Tell us a little bit about how you came to Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Absolutely. So before discussing all of this, I think it's important to note that the situations are very comparable between the life that I'm living and those of some of my characters, but the characters themselves are vastly different. But in terms of my own life, I was living with my, I think, then wife of a couple months in our previous apartment in Clinton Hill, and we were looking to see what we could afford to buy because we were talking about having a family, and the buildings were unaffordable. Even a, you know, one floor within the buildings were out of our price range. But we started looking around in the newspaper, in the New York Times it was, and we saw that just a couple stops farther away from Manhattan, we could afford an entire building on a beautiful tree-lined street in Bed-Stuy. So we borrowed money from everyone we've ever met and immediately rented out the top floor and the bottom and moved into the duplex in the middle.
And so tell us a little bit about the neighborhood that you moved into, Bedford-Stuyvesant, at the time you moved into it. And this is keeping in mind that, well, you must have been among the first, very first wave of gentrification in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
It depends how you want to think about gentrification. And I've had a lot of conversations since writing the book that makes me want to even think harder about what it means to be the first wave of gentrification. I was definitely part of the first wave of white gentrification. Prior to our arrival in the neighborhood 8-9 years ago, my understanding is that there was a wave of primarily black gentrification, people who have made it good in finance or real estate, or, you know, other law, medicine, other businesses, who wanted to move into a black community where they could not only give back to that community after their success, but also live in a world where they didn't constantly feel the need to please white people. So my arrival in that neighborhood really is complicated for a variety of reasons. When we moved in, we were the only white owners on the block, and we still are the only white owners on the block. Everyone else is black. But around the corner, it's gone from, you know, a couple white owners on a block of 80 families to, if not half, you know, at least a third. So the acceleration of the process over the last 5 years has been extraordinary.
Now, my son and his wife and daughter moved in about the same time that you did into Bedford-Stuyvesant, but they didn't buy. They rented. And at the time they started to rent there, it was quite affordable. And by the time they left, which is this year, it had become pretty unaffordable. What have you seen in terms of the impact of gentrification on the community that was there before, largely poor African Americans?
Well, that distinction between buying and renting is so important because the owners on my block, for the most part, benefit from my being there. You know, because of racism, as soon as a white guy moves on the block, other white people find it more appealing and the home values skyrocket. I mean, my home over the last 8-9 years probably has close to doubled because of the amount of white people who are no longer scared of living in an exclusively black neighborhood. So as a homeowner, if your property value doubles and amenities come in, you know, there are more restaurants and grocery stores and drug stores, et cetera, than there were a decade ago. And some of the charter schools have improved and there are other educational options. Although you lose some of the cultural core of the neighborhood with a changing demographic, you benefit in very tangible ways. That being said, renters almost experience it exclusively negatively because many longtime residents have lived there for generations, whose families have been there, whose friends, schoolmates, cousins. Not only do they often feel uncomfortable in sort of new, hip, very expensive venues, but rents that started at, you know, $650, $700 a month for a one bedroom where you can raise a nice family are now $2,500 or approaching $3,000, depending on whether a homeowner puts a little bit more and then tries to rent it for a little bit more. So that dichotomy between longtime residents who own and are materially benefiting from the process of gentrification and renters who are forced out of their homes is dramatic. I mean, Bed-Stuy right now has the largest amount of homelessness of any neighborhood in New York. You see people being pushed out to Brownsville and East New York and Queens. And not that those neighborhoods aren't, you know, lovely in their own ways, but it's just not where members of this community grew up. So you definitely see the fracturing of what had been one of the most stable, largest, pride-filled African-American communities in the country.
Yeah. So why did you want to write Bed-Stuy is Burning?
I saw it as a necessary exploration, I guess. I remember it was 5-6 years ago when it was Police Commissioner Kelly was still the police commissioner, and we were in the midst of stop and frisk policing, which essentially meant that if you fit the description of somebody who is a suspect for a crime in New York, you could be stopped and the police could go through your pockets and find reasons to arrest you. And initially, in my naivete, I saw the police presence that followed gentrification as mostly a positive. You know, I had people who were walking my wife home, but police officers who were walking my wife home from the subway station 8 years ago, and they certainly weren't doing that with anybody else or telling me to put away my iPhone as I was getting out, as though I was a tourist in my own neighborhood. And then it was 5-6 years ago. I remember I'm a middle school teacher as well as a writer. And on my way to work, I think it was 4 out of 5 days in a week, I saw kids not much older than my eighth graders stopped and sort of shackled against that gate that separates the stairs up to the street from those down to the subway. And it was the same kids 3 or 4 days in a row. And I just remember the lived experience of stop and frisk being so difficult, where people can argue about the efficacy and whether it brought down violent crime or whether violent crime was trending in that direction anyway. But seeing these kids mortified on a daily basis and seeing the police stoically going about their job, but clearly not enjoying the process. And then there were all the commuters for whom this was ostensibly done, who couldn't help and who were, you know, just embarrassed by the whole situation. So I remember thinking, what would happen if tensions ratcheted up a little bit, if there was an act of violence between the police and the community? And this was before the race riots in Baltimore and Cleveland and St. Louis. And as I was writing and trying to figure out what these characters were like and doing, you know, I guess a full year of research, both academic and cultural, where I read into the history of Bed-Stuy and the history of gentrification, various methods of policing. I spent hours of informal conversations with my neighbors and formal conversations and interviews with police officers and local high school kids. I just began trying my best to understand how interwoven in beneficial and detrimental ways all these people were. And it was my community. It was where by this time I had had my first kid and my wife was pregnant with my second. And I felt like I needed to have a better understanding of this world. And then as I was starting to understand it, you know, both the world of the gentrifier and the community member where the gentrifier moved in and the police officer and so many other characters, I wanted to do my best to depict it in as honest a way as I could.
One of your characters is actually Bill Bratton, who took over from Ray Kelly as police chief. He has been widely, and I'll use the word condemned, for having initiated the policy broken windows. It's not the same as stop and frisk, but in effect, it may not be all that different. So say, why did you include him in this book and what role does he play in it?
Absolutely. And that transition between stop, question, and frisk and broken window policing is fascinating because Bratton and Bratton's supporters argue that it's a completely different method of policing, whereas stop and frisk meant the police were allowed to stop anybody who looked like somebody who committed a crime. Broken windows was focusing on the minor crimes, like a broken window, for example, with a philosophy that if you police those minor crimes, you would prevent the major ones. But in practice, it was pretty much the same people who were stopped. It wasn't because they fit a profile now. It was because they were loitering or jumping a turnstile or spitting or committing very, very minor crimes that my primarily white students in Manhattan would never and have never been arrested for. So as you say, he is widely condemned by members of some communities, but widely applauded by members of others because of this very technical methodology of policing, Comstat, that he instituted, which means that wherever a crime has been committed, a police officer is, if not immediately, then very quickly situated in that neighborhood, which might, again, have worked statistically, but these statistics are very complicated, but also meant that police officers flooded neighborhoods where they previously hadn't been. And my vision of this novel, because I was taking the risk of trying to present as many sides of this story as possible, I realized halfway through that without including the powers that be, without giving them a voice, without trying to imagine my way into the architect of this system, I was presenting a world that wasn't balanced. It was too many people who were, if not victims, then at least who felt the brunt of these policies, without trying to give voice to the, as I said, architects of these policies. So in an initial draft, I made up a character who is a sort of villainous police commissioner. And I didn't like the degree to which that felt like a caricature. And then it became more and more humanized until it was anybody who was familiar with Bill Bratton would know that I was just doing a Bill Bratton character. So in the same way that the novel takes place in front of a real school, the Boys and Girls School, at a real park, Fulton Park, on a real avenue, Stuyvesant Avenue, you know, mentioning real restaurants and real members of the community, I felt it was important to create the mindset of the real police commissioner who is responsible, or who was at least until he transitioned into his successor, for so much of the day-to-day police experience that both gentrifiers and longtime residents experienced.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Brian Platzer about his debut novel, Bed-Stuy is Burning. So now let's talk a little bit about the novel and its characters. You have Aaron, a lapsed rabbi, and his wife, Amelia, as well as another major character, perhaps not quite as major as them, but is their nanny, Antoinette. Tell us about this trio and the dynamic between them.
Absolutely. What's fascinating in my mind about the dynamic among the three of them was how each of them has power in a certain way over the environment. So the novel takes place over the day of a fictional race riot in contemporary Brooklyn that ends up focusing on the house of Aaron and Amelia because they are the only white family within range of where the riot begins. And I wanted to present the internal machinations of their world before the riot descends on it because of that complicated power structure that I see in a lot of houses where there are two working parents and a caretaker of the child, with whom the child can often have a tender and, if not more meaningful, equally meaningful relationship with the child. So in the situation that I tried to depict, the primary breadwinner of the house at the moment is Aaron, who is a lapsed rabbi. Basically, he was a rabbi for all the reasons I thought it might be fun to be a rabbi, where you get to help people with their problems and be a leader in the community and, you know, analyze the Bible and give speeches and really try to help people out best you can. But as would be the problem for me, Aaron struggles with the fact that just at an intellectual level in a post-Holocaust world, he has trouble believing in an active God and sort of falls apart when he's trying to help people because so much of the vocabulary that he wanted to use would have to rely on, you know, God has a larger plan or this is all for a reason. And he fundamentally stops or maybe never did believe. So he falls apart and
he has another problem.
Right. So what happens is he falls apart and looks for some way to replace the divine in his life and realizes that what he can trust is luck and risk. And he falls into a gambling addiction, which leads to him getting fired from the synagogue. So he has control over his life because he moves on to a job in finance where he can use his analytical skills to make money and some of his gambling skills to understand the numbers. So he is powerful in that it was primarily he who bought the place and has moved in. I also loved the idea of a gambler as standing in for gentrifiers because there's a kind of risk that a lot of us naively, and I think probably with some racial insensitivity, believe that we're taking, where we're, you know, we're on a grand adventure and we're taking all of our money and we're putting it in a neighborhood where, you know, we're not initially comfortable. So the idea of putting all of those thoughts inside the mind of a gambling addict, I thought was a useful way to dramatize that. But at the same time, you have Amelia with whom he is desperately in love and who won't marry him because of a lot of the difficulties in his life. And then you have Antoinette, who is the primary adult in their child's life, because Amelia is a very ambitious woman who's trying to establish her own career. He is trying to come to terms with his own career, combining long hours at work and the occasional poker game. And Antoinette is the one who is essentially raising their child in a world where, although she's Black, she's not African American, and she doesn't have a long history in this community. So she is an insider for some reason in the neighborhood, an outsider for others. So while there's this power structure that's complicated within the house, when the riot occurs and focuses in on their little world, everything that has been problematic or troubling or minorly difficult initially really is brought to the forefront.
Now, what you call the race riot, although I'm not so sure why you call it a race riot. It seems to be that it's really a riot in protest of a police killing of a young boy.
Absolutely. But I'm not sure in the history of the United States if those two categorizations are so dissimilar. I mean, for the most part, the history of riots in the United States, with a few exceptions, but they're few, is the history of police brutality. If you follow, you know, the Watts riots or the riots of 1964 that came from Harlem into Bed-Stuy, or the Rodney King riots, you can characterize them as riots of communities rising up against police brutality. But for the most part, they are racialized because the history of this country is one where the police had extra authority over citizens of color and exerted that authority in often violent ways. So you're absolutely right that Blackness isn't necessarily at the center of the riot in the mind of a lot of the participants. But I think to try to separate Blackness from police violence becomes nearly impossible.
Yeah, I don't think it was that I was thinking of, but I think more typically race riots have, you know, like Tulsa, Oklahoma in the 1920s, race riots were where white people rampaged through Black communities and killed Black people. Whereas many people would talk about the 68 so-called riots as rebellions. So that puts a different kind of tone on it.
And I completely agree with that tone. I think that we've lost a lot of the utility of historical vocabulary in this moment, because people within the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, have been widely cited as referring to these as racial movements and, you know, social mobility, social uprisings that are race-based. So in trying to determine what vocabulary I was comfortable using, I tried to do my best to use the vocabulary of the movements that I was depicting, which sort of leads us into this larger conversation of cultural appropriation and whether it's appropriate for me to be trying to write from the perspective of Black characters at all. And I hear both sides of the argument. I mean, there's one side that says, I don't have the right, and I don't have the right because there's a long history of white people profiting from the suffering of Black people, and my writing the novel does exactly that. Similarly, part of that argument is that publishing is a very white industry still, and white writers have opportunities to tell stories that Black writers don't have. So again, how dare I try to fall into this character and these characters who are living experiences that I myself haven't experienced, but that other writers maybe don't have the opportunity have experienced. And I am very sympathetic to those arguments, and I very strongly disagree with them. I think for me to stay away from trying to see the world through the eyes of Black Americans and to say I don't have the right creates a kind of distancing that somehow suggests their experience is so foreign from mine, and the experience of a white person, a Black person, is so different that, you know, it becomes unimaginable to me. And it creates a barrier between people that I think the job of a writer, in addition to trying to entertain, is to try to empathize across that schism. So I'm not saying that I got it right, but I am saying that to write a novel where I am trying to understand my neighborhood, it was necessary in my mind to do all the research I could, have 1,000 conversations with my neighbors as well as people I don't know, and do my best to try to tell a variety of perspectives of the story, because not to would be to fundamentally mistell this story.
And it's a difficult thing to do. You have one of your characters, Amelia, Aaron's wife. She is a writer, and she writes an article about her neighborhood and about gentrification. And one of the comments in it is that, she is it's a classic example of the white gaze. And you yourself got some of the same kind of criticism. I think it was a review in the New York Times, which said that you didn't explore the black characters in the same depth that you did the white characters. And I just wonder what your response is to that.
My response is that I am always disappointed when a reader doesn't feel I've adequately fleshed out my characters. But I think a lot of the response, a lot of the negative response has to do with politics more than it does literature, where I've had many, many conversations with readers, both black and white, who were excited by the degree to which I painted these characters as not heroes or villains, but sort of average, selfish, sometimes likable, but more often unlikable characters. And if you're coming into reading my book either thinking that the white characters are supposed to be heroic or critical of the idea that black characters can be unlikable when written from the perspective, when written by a white writer, then you're not going to like my book, because I think that the wide spectrum of these characters are, if not unlikable, selfish in the way that I think I would be if there were a violent uprising on my block. And I tried for that to be the check on myself, so I wouldn't have, a heroic white character or a plucky black character or a black character who overcomes the odds, and is heroic in her own way. But I wanted every moment the characters to be recognizably selfish. So in the New York Times review, for example, I'm criticized for not fully fleshing out some of the African-American characters. But the reviewer never mentions the fleshed out African-American characters who you bring up, the black characters like Antoinette, the nanny, or a next door neighbor, Mr. Jupiter. I think it's a novel where I open myself up to criticism if somebody wants to be critical. I am absolutely certain that's true, that there are areas of this novel where if you come in with a perspective of not liking the idea that I'm writing this novel, then there are a variety of ways to not like the novel. But if I think you come in wanting to be entertained and to learn about a world of how so many people affect so many other people's lives, for the vast, vast, vast most part, people have been very generous.
Mm. So what is the response of some of your neighbors who you, interviewed for this? I assume some of them at least must have read the book. What's been their reaction?
That's a great question. And it's a complicated reaction. So initially, because so many of my neighbors have become, great friends of mine, my older son's closest friend lives 3 doors down. And, their initial reaction was pride, as any friend of a finally published novelist would be. And then they read the novel, and I think that a few of them, their first reaction was discomfort that this was how I saw them. I spoke to one of my neighbors whose first reaction was, but we would never let a mob of people, put pressure on your house. We would, of course, look after your kids. Do you think that we would be the sort of people who would allow, you as the white family in this block to be the the recipient of that kind of violence. And I was so horrified by that response, because the answer is no, of course not. Mr. Poyer on the corner would be standing up and defending us, and Crystal and Anthony and Tracy and Kyle, that you guys would be the first one on my stoop. But just like you are noble, lovely, wonderful people, like my wife is the most wonderful woman I've ever met. And the character of Amelia is very much not. You know, I felt that to tell the story in a dynamic way, I wanted to exaggerate some of the less admirable qualities that my friends and neighbors on the block don't have, and that, you know, I hope I don't have, and that I'm certain my wife doesn't have. But I'm certain other people do have. And I wanted to try to create the dynamics that better serve to open up a lot of conversations about the difficult aspects of gentrification. Because my writing a book where I come home and I wave to all my neighbors and my kid hugs his friend and then the book ends, it didn't allow me to get into a lot of the more difficult areas of displacement and police violence and really problems that follow somebody like me moving into Bed-Stuy. So I told them that I loved them and I love my wife and I love all sorts of people whose stand-ins are less lovable.
And so what about those conversations, though, about the difficulties? Did you have them in talking with people, not just before the book, but also afterwards?
Absolutely. One of my closest friends on the block came to one of my first readings and said, "How do you feel you are giving back as much to this neighborhood as you are taking?" You know, where in his mind, and I think very rightfully so, there was this alcove and this world where he could be black in a comfortable way, and culturally there were institutions that he didn't need to build, but that had been there for 50, 60 years, and that he was so proud of, and that gave him so much pleasure. And my moving in, you know, meant that I got their friendships and that I got to live in this traditionally black neighborhood, but this beautiful building on this beautiful block. And I was gaining so much from it. You know, my kids got to experience a diverse group of friends that I couldn't experience when I was growing up. And that really there were real benefits and gains that I was earning. And I didn't have a good answer to him. I think I've been hiding morally behind the researching and writing of this novel for the past decade. That in my mind, if I thought seriously about these issues and I wrote seriously about these issues and I tried to present the perspectives of my neighbors and of the people who were most negatively affected by these changes, I felt in the moment that was, if not all I could do, then enough. Now I don't feel that way. And now I'm having serious conversations with myself and my wife and my kids, to the extent that they can understand it, and my neighbors about what a role for me is next. Because it's so hard to have this conversation and not be patronizing, where, you know, a goal could be I'm spend tons of time in my local library and my kid goes to story time there all the time. So, you know, an initial reaction is that I could start a reading and writing group and, you know, help these kids tell their stories. But there's just something icky about that, where, you know, I'm coming in as a white guy helping the local black kids tell their stories. I'm not sure is the answer, you know, where I'm certain that I now owe the neighborhood something beyond just kindness and getting to know people as people and trying to spend money at the local businesses and black owned stores. But that's not enough. And I'm not sure how to do more. So that's the conversation that I've been having with my neighbors and that I hope to continue having. And that, I think, is indicative of a lot of the lot of the conversations that gentrifiers such as myself are having, where we are benefiting financially and personally, and beyond trying to be nice, don't have a great way to give back. I really don't have a great answer to that question.
Well, you might think about joining the movement for affordable housing in that neighborhood.
Absolutely. But issues of affordable housing are so complicated because although I am a believer in rent control and rent stabilized politics, a lot of our politicians are questioning whether that's the right way to go. And the differences between racial issues and poverty issues are really complicated as well. Like a lot of what Mayor de Blasio is doing to try to remedy the problem is to allow developers to come in, make money with high-end housing, and ensure that a quarter or a third will be subsidized housing where people who are in the lowest income brackets are allowed to buy into those houses. But then you have members of the middle class who say, we don't need more very low-income housing. We already have the public housing units there, and we have high-end and low-end already. We need for a way for the middle class to move in and to replenish the neighborhoods. And just keeping rents at a low rate means that people in the black middle class can't then buy and rent in the way that I'm doing. So I very much want to be a part of the conversation, but I'm not sure I have an answer yet, and I don't really know for what I'd be fighting. So that's what I'm trying to do now. I'm trying to have a lot of conversations with as many people as I can, figure out what battle seems worthy of my time and energy, and then dive in.
And your book is certainly an entree for the reader into those questions. Brian Platzer, your book is Bed-Stuy is Burning, and I want to thank you so much for this fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much. This was such a treat to delve deeply into the issues as well as the book itself. I really, really enjoyed it.
Brian Platzer. You can read an excerpt from Bed-Stuy is Burning by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we listen back to our 2017 interview with Peter Moskowitz about his book, How to Kill a City. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Our theme this episode is gentrification. It's a process that's sweeping cities from New York to San Francisco, from Detroit to New Orleans. We tend to think that gentrification is a natural process, so whether we like it or not, we have to accept it. But when we talked with Peter Moskowitz in May of 2017, he told us it's anything but natural, driven by urban policy that favors the real estate industry and abetted by plunging taxes on the wealthy. His book, How to Kill a City, is a brilliant examination of how gentrification is destroying neighborhoods and contributing to inequality. Let's listen back to an edited version of that interview. Peter Moskowitz, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, you grew up in the West Village in the 1980s, and you say right at the beginning of How to Kill a City that you are both the gentrified and the gentrifier. What do you mean by that?
Yes, so I grew up in the Village, right on the West Side Highway where the Hudson River is, and my parents, in a way, were kind of the first wave of gentrifiers, if you want to call them that. They lived in this loft building that had been converted from a warehouse. And before that, the neighborhood was mostly industrial. I still remember waking up in the morning to the smell of fresh garbage because there was a garbage truck parking garage next door. But in many ways, the neighborhood was really like an ideal place to grow up as a kid. I could walk to school because I knew people along the route. You know, I hung out by myself or with friends, you know, from the age of 10, 11 onwards, just out in the neighborhood because it was really kind of that eyes on the street model of neighborhood living that the famous urbanist Jane Jacobs talks so much about. And Jane Jacobs wrote her book, Death and Life of Great American Cities, about three blocks away from the apartment I grew up in. But by the time I was an adult, the West Village had kind of become a funhouse mirror version of itself. You know, these brownstones selling for $5, $10 million, all the small antique stores turned into Marc Jacobs or Michael Kors or other designers. You know, the pizza places replaced by juicing places. Really, it's even nowadays hard to get a meal for under $15 there. And so the average rent for a one bedroom apartment in the West Village is now $3,500. So when I came back from college, I wanted to live in New York. I was an adult. I didn't want to live with my parents anymore, but I couldn't afford to live in the Village. So I ended up moving to Brooklyn. Well, first Queens and then Brooklyn, and kind of found myself on the other side of the coin where I was the new face of the neighborhood. I found myself frequenting stores that, you know, I would go to and my friends would go to and other white people would go to. But I noticed that the, you know, African-American residents of Bedford-Stuyvesant wouldn't frequent. And people were giving me that same look that I recognized from my own experience, that kind of like, what are you doing here look, which I had been giving people in the West Village when I came back from college to all the millionaires with their Fendi bags and fancy dogs, you know, just kind of this curious look of, you know, you seem like you don't belong here. So that's how I got really interested in this dynamic and in the word gentrification itself, because I saw myself as both a victim and a perpetrator. And I knew if that was the case, then it had to be a bigger process than just, you know, coffee shops and hipsters and the ways we usually hear about it, that it had to be something much larger than that.
Yeah, you know, I think the biggest surprise to your book for me, and probably for many readers, is that I think most of us assume that gentrification is a kind of natural process. You know, my mother was an artist. She bought her loft in an artist building in Soho in 1974. You know, the idea that I grew up with, the urban legend I grew up with, is that the artists moved in, they squatted in Soho because the factory lofts were going empty because they were going down south, and that, you know, the brave artists had to fight the city for the right to stay there and to get artisan residence lofts.
Mm-hmm.
You say it was a lot more deliberate process than that, both in Soho and New York in particular, as well as in general. So tell us about that.
I do think there are several different forms of gentrification. And, you know, what you see now where, let's say, Michael Bloomberg redevelops an entire swath of the Williamsburg waterfront for 30-story condos, that kind of gentrification is obviously slightly different than artists moving into Soho. But I do think that in both cases, they're similar in the sense that they're more top-down than people might realize. Back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, New York City was really trying to deindustrialize itself. And that process actually goes back over 100 years to a plan hatched by politicians and bankers at the time to clear Manhattan of its industrial zones, move all the industrial zones to the outer boroughs, so that way bankers and real estate owners could sell Manhattan real estate at higher prices. So that's been a plan for over 100 years, and you kind of just started to see it come to fruition in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s, when the city essentially rezoned large swaths of the city, converting them from industrial use into commercial and residential use. And they also did things like target Soho with, you know, fire inspections that many believed were unfair, kind of just made it really hard to run an industrial operation in the center of the city. And there's a survey, you know, I don't remember the exact numbers from it, but Sharon Zukin, a professor of planning at NYU, did this survey and found that the majority of industrial manufacturers in Soho would have stayed in Soho if they could have, if the city had allowed them to. So it wasn't just artists moving into this abandoned neighborhood. The neighborhood became abandoned for a reason, and that reason is the government.
And now Soho is basically one of the biggest outdoor malls in the United States. Talk about the purpose of gentrification at heart as being a means for basically promoting capital growth.
Yeah, so you have to go back to how cities are funded these days. If you look at the 70s, 60s, really any decade before that, back to the 20s, the federal tax rate on the richest people was sometimes 90%, sometimes 80%, sometimes 70%. The federal tax rate, the top tax rate, income tax rate right now is around 35%. And with all the loopholes and everything that most wealthy people work into their taxes, it's, you know, closer to something like 15%. So what do taxes pay for? They pay for schools. They pay for roads. They pay for public housing. How did New York build enough public housing to house almost 1 million people back in the 40s? Through high taxes. So now cities are kind of in this conundrum. How do you fund the New York City Public Housing Authority if you don't have any tax revenue? How do you fund the subway system without taxes on the wealthiest people? You essentially have to bring in as many wealthy people and as much capital as possible into your city and state in order to regrow your tax base. So instead of, you know, charging a couple of billionaires high rates, you have to bring in as many millionaires and 100,000-aires as possible so they can pay property taxes to essentially fund your municipal government. So that's that. You know, that's not directly how you get a neighborhood like Soho, but New York City has no reason to want to do anything different with Soho than what it's become. Because as of now, if Louis Vuitton or Nike is paying, or Apple is paying literally sometimes $100,000 a month or more in rent, that tax revenue is going to the city. That's funding public schools. So the city has no incentive to try to save a neighborhood or make it livable for its residents, because it's good for the city if the neighborhood is essentially just a mall.
That's a process of a kind of blandification of the city. And when your title, How to Kill a City, really gets to the heart of that. So how are we killing cities by doing this, by gentrification?
I think there are several ways that we're, quote unquote, killing cities. And I think it's important to point out that the most direct way can literally be through death, like a person's death. If you look at New Orleans, which is one of the four cities I explore in the book, the gentrification of that city was built upon the removal, the forcible removal of tens of thousands of African-American residents and the death of over 3,000 during Hurricane Katrina. Right after Hurricane Katrina, the governor at the time, Kathleen Blanco, said it took the storm of a lifetime to create the opportunity of a lifetime. And real estate investors poured into the city. A conservative government demolished every single public housing project in the city. They turned every single public school except for four into a charter school, and they didn't give enough money for poor black residents to come back. And there was even a lawsuit against FEMA for not adequately distributing funds and giving rich white people more funds than poor black people. So when I say how to kill a city, you know, in that sense, I'm really talking about, this is about death and destruction of a city, of a people, of a culture. In New York, it's not as blatant as that necessarily. You know, you're not seeing forcible removal necessarily. But what you are seeing is, you know, blocks and blocks of real estate being sold off to the highest bidder without regard for what those blocks become. So if you go to Bushwick, where many immigrant families once lived, you'll now see these ugly condos that look like they could be in Miami or Chicago or LA or really anywhere. And if you go to Soho, you know, if you spin around three times, you might be on, sorry, I'm forgetting the name of that boulevard in Los Angeles where all the famous people shop. But yeah, if you spin around three times, you might be there, you might be in a mall. There's really no regard for how a neighborhood works anymore. You know, and as Jane Jacobs talked about, you need diversity in all forms in order for a neighborhood to work, in order for it to not become bland, in order for it to not require massive investment from the government. Because the reason I was able to walk to school when I was 10 years old is because it was not because of a police force, but because there were people that I knew along the route. Now, if you're in Soho, you might not know anyone. The only people there might be the hourly workers who you know, take the train in to work at that Nike store, and you know, it becomes this anonymous neighborhood that loses so much value, even as it gains so much monetary value.
Yeah, you liken gentrification to a ladder that pushes everyone down. You know, the poorest people get pushed off the ladder, but it's not even good for rich people.
Right. Ruthie Dacala, this activist in New Orleans, was the first person who kind of told me that metaphor, which I thought was really a good way to sum up gentrification. It puts the squeeze on everyone. When a city becomes essentially a corporate entity, what happens is that everything becomes a commodity, and whoever can afford the most commodities can live the best life. But the problem with that way of thinking is that once everything is commodified, there's no culture, there's no soul to a city. So you even have, you know, I forget the name of the woman, but she's one of the heads of Forest City Ratner, which is one of the hugest developers in the city. They did Barclays Center. They do some of the biggest, most controversial developments in the city. And she even said, "I'm worried about Brooklyn losing its edge if we develop too much." So, yeah, even the wealthiest people, even the developers, are scared that if gentrification keeps you know, demolishing neighborhoods and kind of stripping them of what makes them great, that they won't be able to make a profit anymore because no one will want to live there. And Jane Jacobs talked about that too, about success destroying success, essentially, that if everyone wants too much of the same thing and there's not enough of it, then you get neighborhoods like Soho or neighborhoods like the Village today.
Well, since you've mentioned Brooklyn, let's stay with that a little bit. Brooklyn, you say, has become the least affordable housing market in the United States. That's a real shocker. We have a mayor, Mayor de Blasio. He ran and won on the issue of income inequality, A Tale of Two Cities.
Right.
And he's talked a lot about the crisis, housing crisis in New York, the crisis of affordability. What has he done to address it?
I'm not a de Blasio fan, to put it mildly. The general problem is cities are addicted to this method of self-funding. You know, in the eyes of someone like de Blasio, there's no way to run a city like New York without encouraging development, because development is what pays the city's bills, especially nowadays when the city has no industry to speak of. It has a small movie industry, the fashion industry is kind of there, but there's no manufacturing. It's really essentially an entire city built on real estate value. So in order to fund the city, de Blasio feels he has no choice except to encourage development. And to that end, he combined the Department of Housing and the Department of Economic Development into one department, which in my view kind of gives it a conflict of interest, and hired Alicia Glenn, whose last position was as investor for Goldman Sachs in urban neighborhoods. So that gives you an idea of her politics. And she now heads that department. So their method of trying to house everyone, and I do believe they have good intentions, or they think they're doing the right thing, but their method is essentially to try to piggyback on pro-capitalist development in order to provide for the poor. So instead of building things like public housing, they're requiring developers who build huge condo complexes in poor neighborhoods to set aside 20 or 25% of that housing for low-income people. And in exchange for doing that, they get to build bigger than they would have without that housing. So I don't know if you see these stories crop up, but, you know, a housing lottery will open for a new rental complex in, say, Williamsburg, and they'll get something like 80,000 applications for 30 apartments. That shows you how insufficient the strategy is, and how much more needs to be done. But unfortunately, de Blasio is not anti-development. He's not saying, let's put the brakes on what's happening. He's saying, let's go full speed ahead. And also, if we can, we'll throw in a little bit for the poor while we do it.
It's kind of like Reagan's trickle-down theory.
Right. I mean, and that's what gentrification is, essentially, is trickle-down economics in city form. The idea that rich people will provide everything a city needs and poor people will, grab onto a few dollars from that.
And where are the poor folks going? Not just in New York, but in the other cities that you look at.
So more and more low-income people and immigrants are moving to the suburbs and exurbs. If you go to, random towns in central and northeastern Pennsylvania, you'll likely see huge populations of Central and South American immigrants. Make the Road, which is a longtime nonprofit in Queens, which serves Latino immigrants, recently opened its second office in Reading, Pennsylvania. So that gives you an idea of where the people they serve are headed. And if you look at San Francisco, for example, people are living an hour, 2 hours away by train or by car. And cities essentially are just becoming these jewel boxes that are meant for tourists and the rich and those who serve the rich, i.e. like the creative class. And everyone else is kind of bussed in to make the city function and then bust out every night.
Now, Peter Moskowitz, in this book, How to Kill a City, you also talk about how to truly not kill a city, how to revive a city, how to make a city more what it was supposed to be, at least in Jane Jacobs' vision. Talk about some of the solutions.
Sure. So I do think we have a long road ahead, and I do think we have to aim high because we're not just talking about building a new subway line or a new park or adding on a few public housing units. We need large actions for things to really change. Yeah, and in the back of the book, I have some direct and kind of, in my view, implementable suggestions that could be implemented if there was political will to do it. And that starts with things like protecting public land, not selling it off to developers. And that can even include things like closing down certain streets or narrowing them. Something like 30% of all land in New York City is roads. And to me, that's a huge waste of space. That includes things like higher taxes on the rich to fund things like public housing. It includes things like universal rent control, which might seem like a pipe dream, but many cities in Europe have it. Berlin just passed it. New York City had rent control that applied to every building built before, I forget what exact year, but sometime in the 1960s. And there's no reason except a lack of political will that something like that couldn't happen again.
And that was Peter Moskowitz talking with us in May of 2017. Moskowitz is a journalist and writer based in Philadelphia. His work has appeared in the New York Times, The Guardian, Vice, and New York Magazine, among other publications. How to Kill a City is out from Nation Books. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.